And I truly believe anybody who says that they understand exactly where we're going to go, I wouldn't listen to them, because we've never been in a situation like this. We've never, as a society, as a civilization, all been impacted by the same thing all at the same time.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experiences and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. For more than a year, all types of territorial borders have been shut down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. International trade and commerce have been throttled, and industry experts predict that business travel may never return to pre-pandemic levels. Global business has long been reliant on building personal relationships, relationships that now must be cultivated and maintained digitally. With such strong restrictions in place, only a select few get a peek behind the curtain. One of CanDo's favorite guests, Dr. Michael Braun, just returned from a two-week trip to the heart of the European business and finance industry, Switzerland. Braun, an entrepreneur, educator, importer, and former investment banker, joins me today to discuss what he found as he crossed continents. We will discuss his firsthand experience in travel, compare the effect of COVID on daily business activity at home and abroad, and what he envisions for global business innovations in the aftertimes. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Welcome back to the show, Mike Braun.
Thanks, Arnie. Thanks for having me.
We've had Mike on before discussing topics as diverse as family business succession planning, cryptocurrency, and blockchain technology. You're a 21st century jack of all trades, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, that's so kind. Thanks, Arnie.
You recently returned from Europe at a time when not many Americans have been abroad in over a year. Why'd you go?
Well, you know, I saw an opportunity, sort of a window, to try to travel and see my parents, who live just outside of Zurich, Switzerland. And it had been over 18 months. And you kind of weigh the risks of going with the risks of not going. And it just seemed that before the sort of the summer rush, and now was a time that I was going to try to make it over there. And it took quite a bit of planning, but I eventually made it.
And you travel both on a US and Swiss passport.
Yes. So I had to do that because unless you have some kind of reason to be in Switzerland, whether you have a long-term visa that you're living there or you're working there, they're not going to let you in. So I was traveling on both passports, leaving the US on the US passport and then entering Switzerland on the Swiss one, and then the same sort of reverse order when I came back.
And what was the transportation part of the trip like, both going and returning?
Yeah, no, it was pretty interesting because, you know, it used to be so easy. You just sort of, you know, go online and book a trip and that was sort of it. But here, it took a lot of forethought in terms of, you know, which airlines and through which airports to go through and which countries, because you have to understand, you know, every country and even every state and every airline has their own set of rules and regulations, right? So what I didn't want to do is actually land or pass through some European Union country because Switzerland is not part of that, and then find out that they had a very different set of regulations. So I really looked at, obviously, airlines and some of the safety and security measures that they had. You know, it seemed that the best way for me to travel was actually out of Kalispell through Minneapolis into JFK and then take a direct on Swiss Airlines right into Zurich. So that's what I ended up planning. And even best laid plans can go awry in this kind of environment.
So we read and hear about the strict COVID regulations abroad. How did you find it in person?
Well, you know, there was a lot more preparation in terms of getting on the plane and then arriving whether it was leaving the U.S. or arriving in Switzerland. So I did the more extensive test, which is called a PCR, prior to leaving here. And then we had a mechanical problem in Minneapolis. And, you know, what is happening right now is that the airlines are running so lean that if something goes awry, it's very difficult for them to bring in, for instance, additional crew or a different plane. So, of course, I ended up missing the flight to Switzerland at JFK. And what that did is that bumped me into the zone where my PCR test was invalid again. So I had to actually get an antigen test about 2 hours before boarding the flight to Switzerland. So it was quite the rigmarole. You know, even just finding a hotel at JFK, you know, these hotels are running pretty lean as well. A lot of them were booked out. Once I did find a hotel, they didn't serve any food or anything. So then, of course, what you're doing is you're DoorDashing it. But even DoorDash doesn't necessarily have a very good system of delivering food to multiple guests at a hotel. And it was very much sort of a Keystone Cops kind of thing where I ended up with wrong orders. And I think right now somebody's eating my tuna sandwich somewhere in the New York borough.
And this is you as a single traveler. Traveling.
Yes.
If you'd be traveling with a group of, you know, business associates or your family, the difficulty would have been exponentially multiplied. So you arrive in Switzerland, you know, one of the most sophisticated countries in the world. How'd you find it? What was your visceral reaction in comparison to the way things are here in Montana?
Well, first of all, just, you know, landing and getting out of the airport was a lot less complicated than I thought it would be. And let me just back up. You know, I flew a 777, which is, you know, one of the largest passenger planes. There were hardly 30 people on there. So it was a ghost plane, if you will. You know, we landed, and again, I had all this paperwork that I had to prepare and sign, but I just walked right out. And it's interesting because I had been told, or I had read at least on the website of the Swiss consulate, that when you travel to Switzerland, you will have to quarantine for 10 days upon arrival, although they would make certain exceptions if you were traveling on business. And I was traveling on both business and personal reasons. However, I walked right out of the airport. There was no sort of tracing or tracking or follow-up for the next 2 weeks that I was there.
And what was the on-ground experience like in terms of comparing Missoula while you were there? I mean, going to restaurants, stores, the way people masked or unmasked, what was that milieu like?
You know what? It wasn't that different from Missoula, Montana. Right. I think once you sort of get out of Missoula, you might find very different mandates and different behaviors. You know, Switzerland is, like I said, not part of the European Union. So they have a lot more leeway to sort of prepare and roll out both, you know, the vaccine and some of the safety protocols and so on and so forth without necessarily having to get the buy-in of, you know, the rest of the EU members. So what I found there was, you know, a lot of the restaurants were closed, but stores were generally open, as were some of the cafes and bars, although those were really providing service outside. I mean, it was pretty good weather. You know, the Swiss are a people that spend a lot of time outside. I mean, one of the national sports is hiking. There are so many trails out there. So, you know, you've seen, just like here in Montana, a real move to spend time in the outdoors. A lot more folks biking, hiking, just spending time where they can, just because the indoors are obviously closed off to them.
If you look in comparison between our experience here domestically and what you're seeing abroad, not only in the health protection sector, but in business in general, is there anything creative going on in Switzerland or Europe in general that we could apply here locally?
I think that's a good question. You know, when you have sort of standalone thermometers that take your temperature as you're walking through a zone, for instance, rather than having somebody sort of point something at your head and telling you to take your hat off or whatever it is, I saw quite a bit of that. But for the rest, let me put it to you this way, Arnie. you know, we've been here, and especially in a place like Missoula, and it's great. I mean, we get to enjoy the outdoors, and you know, we get to jump in the car, and some of us have even gone to, you know, other states. However, there's a little bit of stickiness in our memories about what the world should look like elsewhere that we've been, right? So when I arrived in Switzerland, it was quite a shock to see that, guess what? The pandemic truly is global, and it's there too, right? And it's everywhere. And, you know, everybody's been sort of scrambling at the individual, at the organizational, at the national level to figure out how they can balance this true dilemma of obviously the health aspects and then the economic aspects of daily life, right? You know, Switzerland is fortunate in that it does have less sort of or a lower prevalence of contact industries than, let's say, Italy. I mean, sure, Switzerland has tourism, but then they also have a lot of light manufacturing. I mean, some of the sectors in Switzerland are obviously pharmaceuticals, that's a big one, light machinery, finance and banking, right? And that lends itself much better to sort of making adjustments in a pandemic than Italy, where you have restaurants and where you have cafes and, you know, where they look at millions and millions of tourists coming from abroad and going through Venice, through Rome, through Florence, right? So Italy has fared a lot worse than Switzerland. And, you know, at least what I hear from my friends and family down there, it's really starting to show. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of sort of tension, both at the national level and then obviously in the various regions there.
You make a really important point in laying out this scenario. You know, Missoula is not an island unto itself. You can't get wine in a store in Missoula if there is a blockage in the Suez Canal. And sometimes that doesn't resonate easily with people when they think about community immunity. You know, there is a general thought that once everybody gets vaccinated, this is all over with. But, you know, there's been over 3 million people that have died globally, and a million of those have died in the last 3 months. So it's not tapering off in the rest of the world.
Oh, no, it's actually going the other way. And the WHO just, you know, the World Health Organization just 2 days ago really started to ring the alarm bell saying we're going the wrong way here, right? And by we, I don't mean the U.S. I mean globally, we're going the wrong way. And when we look at places like Brazil, we look at the Eastern Bloc. I mean, Sweden is clocking it at some of the highest rates as well. And of course, it'd be one thing if we knew what we were dealing with. However, you know, what we don't know about COVID really still outweighs what we do know, right? And now we're having to deal with a lot of these variants, you know, how they will manifest themselves, to what extent are the vaccines actually holding up. You know, just yesterday, Pfizer was saying you'll probably need a third shot here, a booster shot by the end of the year. And that's just the reality that we're living in right now. So I just don't foresee sort of a one solution that will get us back to normal. I think this narrative that sometimes gets played out that, you know, there's a way just to go back to how things were. I think we're so far into this by now that the world has truly changed for us forever.
You're involved in corporate training with some of the largest global players. How have they been affected by this, not only pandemic, but the unpredictability of what's transpiring?
What I'm learning is that when you think, or when you're talking to a corporate client and, you know, you have a sense that they know what they're doing, a lot of times they're about as confused as everybody else. It's really difficult to try to manage your workforce that is now a lot of times obviously virtual, it's on Zoom, or, you know, it's having to make adjustments where now even sort of the 9 to 5, you know, 5 days a week schedule is starting to disintegrate, where, you know, there are sort of cycles, we'll bring these folks in and then we'll bring somebody else in. So that's sort of at the logistical level of trying to make sure that the workforce is coordinated and streamlined. And then there's also the fact that, you know, some of these industries, there's a lot of fatigue, right? I mean, we do have frontline workers who really haven't had any reprieve. You know, some industries, if anything, have in sort of a dark way benefited from the pandemic, right? But it's business as usual. It's just been cranked up. So then there's a lot of morale issues that are being addressed in the workplace. And then I do think that that last layer is that, you know, more and more we're relying on some of these new technologies or what are called Industry 4.0 convergence technologies that are coming down the pike very quickly. So they were already on a path to really take over a lot of the functions of different workers of a lot of different professions, but they're being implemented very quickly. So by that, we're talking about anything from AI to drone technology to machine learning and augmented reality to obviously also blockchain, right? And you're seeing the adoption of that really hitting a lot of sectors a lot faster than they were on the trajectory pre-COVID.
You bring up blockchain, and there's been a lot of attention lately to cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and Dogecoin, and Coinbase just went public a few days ago at a tremendously high valuation. There's a whole new sector of the finance world that is, you know, just emerging out of the COVID pandemic to some extent. Switzerland is generally regarded as the banking capital of Europe and maybe of the world. What has been the Swiss reaction to cryptocurrency and blockchain technology?
Yeah, no, great question. And, you know, they fully embraced it. I was fortunate enough to almost be on a pilgrimage when I went to Zug, Switzerland, where my parents live, because that is actually where Ethereum, which is the second largest cryptocurrency, was launched. But Zug is actually known as the crypto valley of Switzerland, if not the world. So you have a lot of innovation going on, right? And that innovation can be anything from, sure, tokenizing digital assets, obviously trading, you know, or creating trading exchanges for cryptocurrencies, to also storage of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. You know, Switzerland has always been sort of at the crossroads of a lot of trade in Europe, from the north to the south and from the east to the west, going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And that's really what gave them sort of their banking reputation early on. Now, you know, we had about a decade ago in Switzerland some issues with some of the privacy laws that, you know, all of a sudden folks who were basically hiding their money in some of the Swiss bank accounts were made to disclose those, especially in the US. So Switzerland lost a little bit of its stature when it came to private banking. So they were very quick to embrace cryptocurrencies and the potential of the blockchain and finance and obviously fintech in general. And now they have a pretty robust and thriving sector around that.
You know, lots of Americans, lots of people in Montana, lots of people we both know can't get their mind wrapped around all of what cryptocurrency and blockchain technology is doing to the business world. I mean, not only the things we're talking about, but there are now auctions of digital paintings that are being sold in the millions. Even the first tweet was sold for over $2 million. It's hard to understand how that has value in the scope of things. Do the Europeans understand it better than we do?
We're still looking at a very sort of niche community that is trying to make sense out of it, right? And, you know, let's go back a little bit and think about what happened in 2017, 2018, where there was a lot of sort of mania around cryptocurrencies that was really retail driven. And it's very similar to what happened sort of in 1999, 2000, where you had eToys and Pets.com and so on and so forth, right? So you had the market crash back then in 2000 with a dot-com boom and bust. Similarly, you had the crypto winter in 2018 where you saw Bitcoin and Ethereum and some of these other tokens just, you know, get decimated. And just like after 2000, 2001, all of a sudden you've got sort of the serious application of, you know, internet technologies when it came to retail and when it came to B2B applications. we're seeing that now. We're seeing a much more sort of thoughtful and utilitarian approach to blockchain technologies and implementing them. And what you were talking about before, which is taking digital assets like videos and, you know, JPEGs and so on and so forth and tokenizing them, those are called NFTs or non-fungible tokens. And it was quite the watershed event about 2 months ago when Christie's, the auction house, auctioned off basically a digital painting by an artist named Beeple. It ended up selling for $69.3 million. And it just sort of was almost like an announcement that NFTs and the value of the blockchain is here to stay. And sure, there's still a lot of hype around it, right? But what we're seeing is that, you know, when, especially in the digital realm, it is so easy for us to make copies of memes, of pictures, of somebody's writing, you know, just take pictures and send it around the world. And what you lose in that is the provenance. So who's the author of that, right? And what are some of the rights that are actually underlying that, whether it's a piece of art or whatever is created there? And in my view, what is happening now with NFTs is that the blockchain is figuring out how to take some of the shortcomings that we've had with Web 1.0 and Web 2.0, including obviously fake news and and the hacking that's going on. And they're building that Web 3.0 that over the next 10, 15 years will really provide obviously a lot more security, but it'll empower the creators, anybody who is creating anything digitally, with a lot more sort of rights and a lot more ownership of what they've created. Let's say that you come up with a meme, which is a funny JPEG, right? And we've all seen them, like the grumpy cat or whatever it is. And of course, we all send it to our friends in a text when we're feeling grumpy or just to make a point or whatever it is. That can now be NFT'd, and actually it has been, and it's been sold. But because there are smart contracts built into it, meaning that there are rules and regulations built into the code, in the future, when it's being used, whenever somebody sort of sends it to somebody, maybe, you know, for 100 times that grumpy cat is sent over text, the owner / creator of that is paid, I don't know, 10 cents, right? And it's not just the owner creator, but that'll be there for a generation. So even, you know, his or her offspring for generations to come will actually have a passive income stream.
We are speaking with University of Montana professor and entrepreneur Mike Braun. Support for this episode of CanDo is provided by Montana Railings, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers and partners. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Mike, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell just said he expects GNP growth to top 6% this year on the back of the COVID vaccine rollout. The last time we had growth like that was in 1984. It's been a long time. Is the rest of the world expecting that same type of growth?
Yeah, no, and it's not. I mean, Switzerland is, and Switzerland is primed to have GDP growth that's almost 8%. But when you look at some of the other countries like Italy and France and even Germany that are still struggling to contain, you know, the COVID spread, they're going to have a much harder time getting to those numbers. In one breath, we're talking about markets, whether it's the NASDAQ or the Dow, but the public markets being completely frothy. I mean, today was another record day. And folks are saying, listen, you know, this can't continue, right? But meanwhile, you'd have some analysts who are saying, no, get ready. This will be the roaring 20s, if anything. Similarly, we're seeing the same thing with the housing market, which, you know, on a domestic level is, it's just record breaking. I mean, we see it right here in Montana where sight unseen, some of these things are getting picked off at 20% above ask. I just heard today that in Florida and Southern Florida, some condos are going above 70%. That's been the appreciation, 70% appreciation from pre-COVID. Now, that's all good. However, we also have to take into account the supply side, right? That now we're running out of houses, for instance, right? People can't find them. So you can try to sell something, but then where are you going to live as the seller because you can't buy something on the other side? We hear about construction. I mean, construction is so backlogged. The price of lumber on the low end is 2x, so twice as expensive. On the high end, it's 5x, so five times, right? And that's if you can get it. And this is the same case that I heard in Switzerland with construction. Why is that? Well, because people are saying, okay, I'm going to be at home. I'm going to live sort of more regionally, more locally, if you will. I'm going to put another pop-up. I see decks happening left, right, and center, right? People are saying, well, you know what? I'm going to expand my footprint and everything. But even trying to get labor is really difficult. What does that all mean? Well, it means that inflationary pressures are really going to become, they're already rearing their head, but they might accelerate. And with inflation, you know, what that means, folks, is that the value of your dollar just erodes a lot more quickly. So, you know, there's going to be investments that make more sense than others as people are trying to maintain the value of their net worth, especially their cash and everything. I think that there is so much murkiness around this, Arnie, that I wouldn't be willing to bet on anything at this point. And I truly believe anybody who says that they understand exactly where we're going to go, I wouldn't listen to them because we've never been in a situation like this. We've never, as a society, as a civilization, all been impacted by the same thing all at the same time. Whether you're in the jungles of Borneo or on the outskirts of the Arctic Circle, you know, COVID is everywhere. And we're just having to learn how to deal with it. And there are explicit impacts. We can all say, yes, and now I wear a mask and so on and so forth. And then there are things below the surface that we don't really understand yet or actually see how they've impacted us, right? And I think all of those are going to play out over the months and years to come.
Did the pandemic, in an unexpected way, end up speeding along new business innovation?
Oh, big time. Oh, yeah. And you know, let me again contextualize this in some of the stuff that I do with recessions. I mean, recessions are a form of what Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, called creative destruction. So when you get a recession, old business models, so some of these, you know, industries and some of the companies who were limping into the recession get destroyed. However, in a creative manner where now you have new business models that arise and end up with compelling value propositions for consumers. And we saw this in the last recession in 2009, 2010, as an example, Airbnb. So people are saying, okay, I don't necessarily have money and I don't want to be in a big hotel because they cost a lot and so on and so forth. And Airbnb said, okay, we'll give you the flexibility of renting somebody else's place, you know, who's looking to make additional income at a favorable price, right? So Airbnb came out of that. And I think we're going to see amazing innovations during this time. Already, we are seeing some of these old industries sort of being destroyed, but they will lay ground to new creative innovations where you're going to see the different value propositions that really fit the emerging consumer across all generations.
Do you envision business ever returning to the practices that they engaged in pre-COVID in the work, travel, in high-touch engagement, in being in an office cubicle? Is that bygone now, or is there going to be a renaissance for that?
Arnie, let me put it to you this way. I wouldn't want to be in the commercial real estate business right now. Okay, so what does that mean? Right now, this is the great experiment. And it truly is a great experiment because before it was a thought experiment. What if everybody just worked from home? Or what if we didn't travel for sales meetings? And then obviously, then it all came true. And what we're seeing now is that companies are figuring out how to make do. And companies are also finding that, boy, they can get a lot of productivity without the expenses from before, right? So we already heard, for instance, Salesforce, one of the big tech companies that said, listen, you won't ever have to come back to the office, right? Others are saying, no, we're going to sort of figure out a hybrid working relationship, you know, where you come in for certain things and for others, we're going to give you flexibility to stay at home. And I do think that it'll be somewhere in between and that every sort of sector, every industry and every company is going to have to find sort of that sweet spot, right? However, when it comes to sort of office space, there's going to be a much more strategic approach to it, right? Sort of this idea that we're going to show up 5 days a week and punch in at 9 and punch out at 5, that's just so silly. I mean, that is a remnant from the previous Industrial Revolution. We just don't need to do that anymore. So now it'll be like, okay, here's what we're going to do, especially for employees who are being onboarded. Maybe the first year they're spending more time at the office, they're coming in, so we can sort of inculcate them with culture and everything. And then strategically, we're going to have offices in places where, you know, maybe they're closer to the client, or we're sort of going to put a pin somewhere and see who's working around there remotely, but they can come in every 2 weeks and we can train them up or reskill them, upskill them. So it'll be much more thoughtful in that way. Now, I will also tell you, though, that there is going to be tension between employer and employee, because right now employees are saying, okay, we can do what we're doing. You know what, stay at home and we'll give you $5,000 to basically equip your home office. And employees are saying, well, okay, I appreciate that, but I'm still having to sort of deal with my kids at home, right? They're not going to school. What do I do with daycare? I mean, there's just so much out there that is having to be worked through. And, you know, as somebody who is very interested in the future of work, I really try to keep an eye on what that means for the worker. It's not just about technologies. It's not just about new arrangements. It's also about workers' rights and how they will actually be productive, but how they will also simultaneously actually, you know, lead a fulfilling life that has sort of this work-life balance, if that's at all possible.
You know, in some weird way, I feel a little bit more pressure working from home than when I used to go in the office. There are folks that just assume you're on 24-hour call. There is something about the regimentation of being, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 or 10 hours at work, and then that's where people get you, and they don't really bother you too much outside of that. That boundary is now gone.
Oh, and the onus is on you, right? I mean, it's on everybody sort of to say, okay, I'm going to show up. I'm going to show up sort of, you know, in that business mindset. However, at the same time, Arnie, you know, I think that we need to be cautious about not confusing presence with productivity. Because you think about the 9 to 5 or the 8 to 6 or whatever, how much of that was actually full on productivity, right? And, you know, I mean, some of the statistics are like maybe 30 to 40%. I think that the accidental innovation and productivity that happens, that's still important, but you know, that doesn't get you to 100% of the 9 to 5 schedule. I mean, I've had this, my colleagues have this, where you get up in the morning at 8 o'clock, you're going to have, you know, 5 or 6 1 hour meetings that are just stacked up. And you know, there has to be a way for us to think a little bit more creatively around what fits into a sort of a Zoom meeting and what should be discussed here versus other channels of communication that can maybe take some of that rigidity out of how we do things. And, you know, now it's your availability whenever, wherever, especially with programs like, you know, Zoom that gets scheduled into Microsoft Outlook. It's always like, let's meet for an hour, right? That's the default. And a lot of times it's like, you just don't need all of that time. So we're seeing burnout, right? People are burned out. They're burned out from obviously, you know, sitting in front of Zoom. They're burned out from not having sort of even in just in their minds, the freedom, the flexibility, the prospect of plans of a vacation somewhere, you know, whatever that may be. So I do believe that we're maybe primed to hit a little bit of a wall here in terms of worker productivity after all this time. And, you know, who knows, maybe some of the employers will say, fine, then come back to the office, you know, because we're missing having bodies there, having some of the ideas, the innovations around the water cooler, where it often happens, you know, just that culture building that's really been adversely impacted over the last 15 months. And we'll have to see how that plays out.
Last question for you, Mike. 15 months ago, you're teaching in the classroom, you're doing corporate training in group settings, you're importing wine, you're going to Europe to meet with your partners. That's all gone now. How has these changes affected you personally?
Well, Arnie, I'm still doing a lot of those things, right? Actually, I'm doing all of them. I'm still teaching, except I'm teaching using Zoom. I'm still doing corporate training, and I work with a lot of companies, and some of it is being done virtually using Zoom, but we also do have in-person training that's been happening. And obviously we follow all the safety protocols. And yes, the wine business, it's, you know, you figure it out, right? And that's a sort of a favorite saying that we have in the family here. It's like, we're smart, we'll figure it out. And that's what everybody's doing. They're just trying to figure out hacks and workarounds to continue to sort of move things forward. It's interesting to be in higher ed still. I mean, universities and colleges had been talking for 20 years about moving online and sort of, you know, migrating some of their offerings to distance learning and so on and so forth. Folks, it took them 10 days over spring break to fully go online, right? And now what that means is, like any other industry, any other sector, there's a little bit of saying, okay, we know we can leverage technology. It changes our cost structure. We have to think about how, you know, we change some of the incentives, how we change the value proposition for learners. You know, it in some cases, it'll work just to, you know, be on Zoom or have some what's called asynchronous learning that is basically just a, you know, an instructor who's a facilitator and curator. In other cases, you need a much more high touch environment, a live environment, for instance, if you're doing labs, right? So, I mean, like any industry, like any sector, higher ed right now is going through a tremendous upheaval, and we don't necessarily know where it's going to land. But, you know, just like me, my colleagues, you know, administrators, the leadership in higher ed, they're moving forward and they're saying, we're going to be flexible, we're going to be agile, we're going to try things, we're going to try to be transparent and keep the communication open to figure out how we can actually deliver value to, in this case, you know, the learner, the customer. I think that'll just be a little bit of the phase that we're in for a while.
And that kind of approach applies to almost any industry.
Pretty much. Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, look at the airlines, right? And Arnie, I mean, you've been to a couple of hotels. You've seen how they're trying to meet you where you are by doing what they can do. Some of it works and other things don't. And I think, you know, anybody who says, well, this is how we've always done it, that's a discussion stopper right there, right?
It's a recipe for disaster.
Oh, completely, completely. So, you know, experiment, try things out as much as you can, see what works, try to scale it. If it doesn't work, pivot.
Mike, as always, it's good to catch up with you and get your take on the wonderful world of business. I really appreciate it.
Arnie, thanks so much. It's great, you know, to have a person to talk to and to share some of these thoughts and views and ideas. And I would tell everybody, just these are views and opinions. Who knows what the world will look like, but be well and Godspeed.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin, in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time when I'll talk with Will Price of Next Frontier Capital and Michael Fitzgerald of Submittable about Montana's startup ecosystem. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.